the Supreme Court agreed that working time extends to periods when the drivers are logged into the Uber app and not only when they're carrying passengers. And this, of course, is huge.
We told the president-elect, you've got to get rid of this guy because he could do a lot of damage, you know, in the first 90 days mm-hmm. of your term, and he fired him on day one.
Every single minute costs your boss money. So your main job is to figure out how to take fewer steps, make fewer cuts, and get more for each and every minute that you spend on the job.
But session singers record vocals. They record background vocals. They record lead vocals. A lot of times when people think of us as background singers, they forget that some of the greatest singers that we have are background singers. The definition of session singers is simple. What we do, though, isn't.
As a consequence of the Memphis Sanitation Station strike, I came to recognize the priority in my life of working for social change, personal change, that I came to recognize that my first vocation as pastor of local congregations, helping them to understand the issues of the spirit and the mind and the heart and the soul as applied to daily living and to the issues in the community and in the nation as a whole.
Today marks the beginning of the end of scapegoating educators for the social ills that all of our children, families, and schools struggle against every day.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, Radio Labor's report on the ruling by the UK Supreme Court that Uber drivers are Uber workers. AFL-CIO Government Affairs Director Bill Samuel talks with America's Workforce Radio about President Biden's early pro-labor actions. From Grit Northwest, Carpenter Stories with journeyman carpenter Laurie Goner. The SAG-AFTRA podcast explores becoming a successful session singer. On Welcome to Uniontown, a visit with Reverend James Lawson, a leading theoretician and tactician of nonviolence within the civil rights movement. And Labor Radio Express mourns the passing of Karen Lewis, the legendary former president of the Chicago Teachers Union. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
This is a Radio Labor report recorded on Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. I'm Mark Belanger. In the United Kingdom recently, the country's Supreme Court ruled on the employment status of Uber drivers. Uber argues that its drivers are independent contractors, not employees. The labor movement says that they are because of the rules and regulations they have to abide by. To find out how the ruling could affect workers in the UK, I talked to Rowan Subbasinghe. Mr. Subbasinghe is the legal director of the International Transport Workers Federation, the ITF. I asked him about the ruling of the UK court.
This case basically centered on two drivers, Yaseen Aslam and James Farah, who are the lead claimants in this case, who took Uber to court on behalf of a group of 23 other drivers claiming that they are workers. And worker status is the intermediary category between employee and the self-employed under English law. And worker status basically requires a contract for services and is still a form of self-employment, but one that guarantees fundamental workers' rights like the minimum wage, holiday pay, and protection against discrimination. And the workers won in the employment tribunal, which is the court of first instance for employment claims in the UK. But of course, Uber appealed, and the Supreme Court really represented the fourth and final time, Uber could argue that their drivers are self-employed partners rather than workers. However, the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court was that it agreed with the Employment Tribunal, the Employment Appeal Tribunal, and the Court of Appeal that drivers are workers rather than self-employed independent contractors. Now, again, I think it's important to highlight that this was a unanimous decision with no judges dissenting, and the fact that the Supreme Court reiterated the level of control Uber has over its drivers by setting fares, by having the power to deactivate drivers who don't accept rides, by using the rating given to drivers to manage their performance, and so on. And I think that a really important part of the judgment was that the Supreme Court basically guided lower courts to actually look at the working arrangements themselves as opposed to relying on contract language that would purport to classify drivers as independent contractors. And in doing this, they held that the purpose of employment protection legislation is precisely to protect workers who are paid too little for the work that they do, who work excessive hours, so on and so forth. And I think that this is particularly important when we, you know, bear in mind the gig economy and the situation gig workers are placed in. And one final point, and I think this is also a critical one, is that the Supreme Court agreed with the Employment Tribunal that working time extends to periods when the drivers are logged into the Uber app and not only when they're carrying passengers. And this, of course, is huge if you consider the amount of time drivers have to cruise looking for passengers. So overall, a pretty incredible ruling from the UK Supreme Court.
What are the implications of this court decision for the Uber drivers in the UK?
If we look at the 25 drivers who were party to this particular case, now the case will return to the Employment Tribunal, which will decide on how much compensation they're actually entitled to. Now, in terms of looking at this from a wider perspective, thousands of other claims by drivers were actually stayed pending the Supreme Court outcome. Some sources already estimate that Uber may have to pay up to £100 million to over 10,000 drivers who have claims currently pending before the court. So the implications for Uber drivers in the UK is absolutely huge. And I would say that this goes even beyond Uber drivers, because there are several cases pending before the courts relating to other private hire car companies like Addison Lee, for example, which is a very large private hire company in London. And this decision could prove crucial for those workers as well. So the implications for Uber drivers and similarly situated drivers in the UK is absolutely huge.
And that's it. Labour news you can use. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America. Here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Bill Samuel is Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org. Hey, Bill, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today, buddy?
We're doing a lot better. It's been a lot better since January 20th.
Things are happening.
Things are looking up. Things are happening. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you know, one of my friends, Chris LaGrange, he runs the UCOM blog. UCOMblog.com is a website. Great labor guy. Works out of the New England area and New York area, New Jersey. And he pointed out the 20 things that Biden has done for unions. And it's amazing. It's amazing. It's almost like it happened overnight, and it's all good. In fact, the latest was the general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, Jennifer Abruzzo. Do you know her, by the way?
I know her very well. In fact, not only did he nominate a union side attorney, by the way, she had worked at the NLRB, so she's a professional. She has lots of experience before she went to CWA, so that she's a good pick. But he fired, he made room for this new general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, by firing the old general counsel on the first day of his presidency, and the old General Counsel Peter Robb was a management lawyer who was on a mission to destroy unions. He was moving cases and rulemakings through the board at a really quick pace. And we told the president-elect, you've got to get rid of this guy because he could do a lot of damage, you know, in the first 90 days mm-hmm. of your term. And he fired him on day one.
So, didn't mess.
One of the 20 things. I think, by the way, I think there's more than 20 things he's done.
Yeah, Bill, our dear friend Virginia Fox out of North Carolina, who hates unions, and she is the Republican leader on the Education and Labor Committee. She was quick to comment on Jennifer Abruzzo's appointment. She said, rather than nominate a demonstrated union sympathizer with a potential conflict of interest, Biden should reinstate Peter Robb so he can honorably serve out the remainder of his 4-year term.
Well, you know, it just shows you how twisted they are. I mean, calling Jennifer a union sympathizer as if that's a bad thing. If you go back and read the National Labor Relations Act, which I'm sure you've talked about, you know, countless times on the show, it actually begins by saying it is the policy of the United States government to encourage collective bargaining. Now, I don't know if that makes a union sympathizer a bad thing, but it sure doesn't sound that way. It sounds like that's something you want in that job, to promote collective bargaining and organizing. And President Biden has actually gone a little bit further. He's now saying it's the policy of his administration to support union organizing and collective bargaining. He said that, early in his presidency. And it really is that the board is going to be totally transformed. There's a vacancy now, in addition to the general counsel being replaced. There's a vacancy on the board, which will give us a 3-2 majority, which will mean all the cases that come forward from this point forward are going to be decided by a much better, fairer board that actually believes in collective bargaining and union organizing.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
Hi, my name is Joe Cadwell, and I'm the writer, producer, and host of Grit Northwest, and I'd like to welcome you to another edition of Carpenter Stories. This series will introduce you to individuals whose lives have been changed for the better after finding a career as a professional craftsperson. In today's episode, we meet Lori Goner, journey-level carpenter from the local 1503 in Portland, Oregon. Lori Goner, welcome to Carpenter Stories.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for taking your time on a Saturday morning to talk with me on Carpenter Stories. Lori, I'm really interested in your backstory and how you got to join the Carpenters Union. So how did that begin for you?
I started off working in an office, and I then wound up in the laborers for a short time and changed my book to the Carpenters because it was really more where my interests lay.
And when you came into the Carpenters, did you go straight into the field, or did you go through a pre-apprentice or the apprenticeship program?
I finished the Oregon Tradeswomen pre-apprenticeship in 2014, and I went straight into the pre-apprenticeship program. Amber McCoy had just started it at the Carpenters Union, and it was over there in the training center. And that's where I went next, and then to the field.
And so you came over from the laborers, you found the pre-apprentice program. And what did you like about carpentry?
I've always been somebody that wanted to make things with my hands. It's very satisfying to have something finished that you can use or look at when you're done doing your work. That was what I enjoy, one of the things I enjoy the most about being a carpenter.
Yeah, I'm beginning to think of that as the step back moment. When you finish a day's work and you can put your hands on your hips and look over at what you've accomplished that day, you and your crew really have that pride and appreciation that, yeah, we built this. And then that's going to be here for years and years, depending on what project it is, could be potentially building the wealth of this nation, those office buildings, those banks, those schools. And that is a very satisfying component of our craft for sure. So after the pre-apprenticeship, you went into the apprenticeship program at PNCI here in Portland, didn't you?
I did.
And what did you like, or what did you take away? Let's see, what did you take away from your experience as an apprentice?
That it's a very different world from the world I'd always worked in, which would be not just non-union, but quote office type jobs, quote white collar work. It's a very different world. And that was actually my largest learning curve, not how to swing hammer. So it's been a real chance for me to be a better human.
So the skill craft, it sounds like, came fairly easy for you, the actual mechanics of being a carpenter. But when you say the it's different than a white collar world, what do you mean by that?
Every single minute costs your boss money. So your main job is to figure out how to take fewer steps, make fewer cuts, and get more for each and every minute that you spend on the job. That seems obvious at first, then that when you come in, you think, okay, I need to be efficient. Well, being really specific about how efficient you are is the name of the game there.
Yeah, for sure. There's some really tight profit margins for our contractors in commercial construction. And you're right. Every miscut or every misstep could potentially cut into our contractor's bottom line. And it's important that you've recognized that and want to try to improve yourself. Did you feel like, Lori, when you were in the program, you got paired up with some caring journey level workers?
I got a few rock stars, that's for sure. I still remember exactly who they are and exactly what they told me and how useful the information was. I do also have a sense of sympathy for many of them, though, based on my first experiences here recently as a journeyman trying to offer information to an apprentice. All of you out there who remember me as an apprentice with less than fondness, I apologize.
So what would you say separated these rock star mentors that you came across? What was it that made them stand apart from the rest?
They were less concerned with telling me what to do than making sure I learned something. Some people get very carried away with, you have to do what I say, which is obvious. It's so obvious, it almost doesn't need to be said. But those people were just like, hey, try this. Hey, what's going on? They were like focused in on what was happening, not who was doing the work. Like me being female versus them not being female kind of thing. That just never even entered their conversation.
Did you feel that these individuals, Lori, had a better than average level of communication skills?
I would say yes on the surface, but the life experience of these people tended to be many times when they were guys, they were people with single mothers. They'd grown up with a single mother, or they had lots of sisters, or they had a successful marriage with children. They were people with a very specific set of life experiences. Whether they had a proper English is not what I'm speaking to. And I think you know that, but that it's not about how your sentence structure looks. It's about how you relate to other people.
They had empathy. And so is that usually the case in the construction field from your observation as a woman in the trades?
Coming to be really blunt, no. That's why I call them rock stars. There aren't very many rock stars. And I know that there are lots of guys out there that I didn't happen to work with that are just have their rock star thing too. I just didn't happen to meet them. So like I said, I'm very glad for the ones I did meet.
What have you taken or had the most pride in since joining the union? What accomplishment, what achievement can you put your finger on and say, yes, this is it for me at this point?
My card. That sounds hokey, but my card. It was a near thing. I wasn't 100% sure I was going to make it. And it was a very difficult 4 years. So my card.
That's awesome.
My little steel card that I have carry with me everywhere now.
And that's your journey level card as a carpenter of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America. Awesome. Lori Garner, thank you so much for taking your time to be on Carpenter Stories today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Our guest today has been Lori Garner, journeyman carpenter from the 1503.
Welcome, everybody, to the SAG-AFTRA podcast. I'm Gabrielle Carteris, president of SAG-AFTRA.
I'm David White, National Executive Director of SAG-AFTRA.
Today, we spotlight session singers, their history in the music industry, the challenges they face, how they've worked with SAG-AFTRA to help secure better rights, to make sure that they are heard and seen.
And we are thrilled to have two of the most successful and influential session vocalists, not to mention just outstanding singers, with us today.
For sure. First of all, I want to introduce Janice Pendarvis. She's a legendary singer, songwriter, voice actor. She's been working in the music industry for over 4 decades. Congratulations on that. Her credits are absolutely incredible. She's worked with artists such as David Bowie, the Rolling Stones, Steely Dan, Roberta Flack, the OJs, Brandy, Sting. She also teaches voice at Berklee College of Music in Boston and NYU Steinhardt School. Janice also serves on SAG-AFTRA's National Board.
And I'm grateful that we are also joined here today by singer-songwriter extraordinaire Carlos Ricketts Jr. Carlos has been singing since he was 8 years old, with dreams of becoming a professional singer even as early as that. He realized those dreams in a big way, we're all happy to say, and we've all benefited from this realization. He's performed and recorded with such artists as U2, Willie Nelson, John Mayer, Mary J. Blige, and Michael Bublé. Carlos, we're very happy to have you with us here today.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, welcome really to both of you. And I think the best way to start off, because this is a window into the lives of session singers and singing artists, period. So maybe can you just tell us, what is a session singer? What is the job of a session?
What session singers do, and I want to put session singers under another term that really I have to thank SAG-AFTRA. One of the SAG-AFTRA organizers came up with this term to apply to this group of singers, is professional singers. Under the heading of professional singers, you have your session singers, your background singers, the people who are the rank and file of the singers in our union. But session singers record vocals. They record background vocals. They record lead vocals. A lot of times when people think of us as background singers, they forget that some of the greatest singers that we have are background singers, and they're great at singing lead. And Luther Vandross is a perfect example. There's a whole group of us who came up with him when he was a session singer, and then he broke away from the pack and became one of the greatest soul singers that has existed. But the definition of session singers is simple. What we do, though, isn't.
And Carlos shakes his head in agreement. He's going, yes, it's true. It's true.
So it is so about relationships. And there are all of these just unspoken rules and manners and mores, and which change and morph over time. But that's something that you have to be to pay attention to. So I always say to people who are new, come in, get there early, be nice, and observe. Learn what's happening before you put your foot in your mouth.
I just want to say that is golden in terms of, right, we don't have agents. We depend on each other in terms of referrals and things of that nature. And one thing that I learned that I would say to anyone new when networking, also to consider who would need you. If you're a tenor and you only network with tenors, guess what? You're in trouble.
So I'm the father of an 11-year-old. She likes to sing. And if there were an opportunity for her to sing, and would I want her to go into this life? And I'm also very curious to know, are you on the road all the time? Are you in your own studio singing and then putting tracks out and now via TikTok or Zoom or whatever?
So I think daily life varies from day to day because there's so many things that go into being a freelance singer. There are times that you're on the road. If you're lucky, you'll get a long tour for 6 months, a year, which means that you're gainfully employed traveling in the States and beyond. If you don't aim for it, you won't get it. Aim for a gig where you can pay your rent and be gone at the same time. When you're traveling, if it's a long-term tour, you're gone 1 to 2 months at a time. You come home for a week or two, you're gone again. But then there are the smaller gigs where you may only go out on the weekend. And those are great if you have developed an active clientele that will keep you busy in studios or recording at home during the week. There are a lot of people who do all kinds of things together. They're recording, whether they're at home or they carry gear on the road, and they will record from a hotel room while they're gone. My thing is, listen, do as much of it as you possibly can, as long as you can, and keep looking ahead to where things are going. Because the one thing about the business right now, compared from the world that I came from, is the changes are happening rapidly. Got to keep up with the technology as well as the different ways that people market themselves. And 5 years ago, no TikTok. Now, TikTok. And who knows what else is coming.
Absolutely. And David, you mentioned your 11-year-old daughter and would she want to be in this business and using TikTok and things of that nature. I think it's amazing that people are actually getting discovered doing that. I've noticed a fearlessness because it just is what it is, like especially in her age group. So me as someone who used to read a cassette tape, I'm like, okay, how do you do it? Now, where do I, so I download it where? And then what do I have to do? I need, so there are all of these different questions that come just from being here before it was here. I know people who can sing circles around me, like sing me under a table. But if you can do that and people don't want to be around you, what's the point? Because when you leave your home to go on tour, you are living with people. It's not the 2 hours on stage. This is your home for the next 6 months. So you want to make sure that in addition to having your talent and your technique, that you actually just are a great person to be around, that you're kind, and that this is a gift that we're sharing.
We thank you as well.
Thank you so much, you guys.
This is Hugo Romero, and you're listening to Welcome to Uniontown with my co-host, President Ron Herrera. Today, we welcome to Uniontown Reverend James Lawson. He is one of the civil rights movement's leading theoreticians and tacticians in the African-American struggle for freedom and equality. On the eve of the assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. called him the leading theorist and strategist of nonviolence in the world. He's also a Los Angeles hero, having worked with hotel workers, janitors, home care workers, and undocumented immigrant youth in historic organizing victories. We hope you enjoy our discussion as much as we did.
I hope everything is well with you.
Yes, I think as well as I can be.
So I was wondering if you could share with us how you came to LA and why you decided to make it your home after having been instrumental in the South and having done so much work there. And
all right, I'll try to do this very quickly. It's a big question, a long question, a question that covers at least five decades now. In 1958, I dropped out of graduate school in Ohio to move to Nashville, Tennessee, to participate in the emerging movement that I identified as the Rosa Parks Martin Luther King Nonviolent Movement of America. That movement is a part of the larger movement called the Civil Rights Movement, which began in 1866 with the first Civil Rights Act passed by Congress, which said that everyone born in the United States and its territories is a citizen of the United States. So I want to lift up the fact that it's essential for us to see the civil rights movement as a large umbrella movement of which there are many sub-movements. In any case, I had been for 17 years working with Martin Luther King Jr. in 13 of those years until his assassination, doing the Memphis sanitation strike, the garbage workers strike, of which I was perhaps the primary Memphis pastor engaged in it and helping to organize it and work with it and organizing the support base for that strike of 1,300 mostly African-American workers who were working for the city government but living in poverty. And that became the first campaign of the Nonviolent Movement of America, in which I participated, in which labor workers' strike was at the center, and was strike was the major nonviolent tactic. And a bishop in Los Angeles of our Methodist church wanted me to come to LA as the pastor of the Holman United Methodist Church. And I reluctantly, hard to break away from the Southeast and from Memphis, where I'd been for 12 years, I did, after a hard personal struggle, decide that I should be in Los Angeles at Holman United Methodist Church. So that's how I came to LA in 1974. And of course, I came with some reputation as being involved with Dr. King. In fact, I was called by many people the nonviolent teacher and mind of our movement. So I came to LA with that reputation as well. And as a consequence of the Memphis sanitation strike, I came to recognize the priority in my life of working for social change, personal change. But I came to recognize that my first vocation as pastor of local congregations, helping them to understand the issues of the spirit and the mind and the heart and the soul as applied to daily living and to the issues in the community and in the nation as a whole. And so I relish my history in LA, where now I've spent the biggest part of my life and as an adult, LA. So I've had the privilege here of working with AFL-CIO, in particular, Local 11 Unite Here. I began with them back in the 1980s. One of my favorite stories would be how Maria Elena DeRosso, now a senator in our state legislature, became the president of Local 11 and called me and asked me to become a teacher of nonviolent philosophy and methodologies. And so that launched, therefore, my official relationships with the Labor Federation. And one of my favorite stories about that is how on any number of occasions, Maria Elena DeRosso and I, in planning our activities and planning our campaigns, often agreed that we would, in the demonstration that might be a justice demonstration at the corner of Figueroa and Exposition, for an example, when we were working on the labor issues at USC, we agreed that we would stick close to each other so that when we were arrested, we could continue talking and planning and strategizing in the ride to the jail station and in the holding pen, where often 15 or 20 of us or 40 of us would be lodged as we were being booked, we could continue our thinking about the struggle and what we were doing and what we had yet to do. So on two or three occasions, we were able to make that happen. We used civil disobedience in the campaign as an opportunity to continue consulting and examining the issues and helping to plan the work of a strike or a sit-in demonstration, of course, a variety of kinds of nonviolent tactics that we used. As a pastor ordained in United Methodist Church and the Methodist tradition of Christianity, I maintain that local religious congregations, most of whose members are working people. That was especially true in my congregations in Memphis, in Tennessee, and Los Angeles. They were 99% Black congregations. Economic justice can emerge as well as gender, racial justice, as well as a community
that we can call the beloved community. That is a community that has minimal violence against people. Dismantling of the violent culture in which we live, especially the violence of the spirit, because the January 6th assault upon a wonderful Capitol building that is a symbol of our legislative governance and all shows you how mean and despicable violence is. Mm-hmm. It has no justice or mercy in its mind. So you see there the spirit of violence in its worst form. So the religious congregations must be engaged in the economic well-being of their people who want to sustain and support themselves and want to have access to all of the aspirations of life. And I maintain that for me, my major ally in that pursuit is the organizing of working people into unions that have in mind justice for the community, economic opportunity and justice. I don't know if that's muddled or if that's fairly clear.
I just want to say thank you, Reverend Lawson, for giving Los Angeles the opportunity here today to listen to your teaching and your mentorship. Truly amazing.
I want to just simply urge you to go on. 800,000 union members is wonderful, but it needs to be 2 million or 3 million in the Los Angeles region over the next decade or so. So let's go on and see what will happen, because I think it's marvelous. And I want to thank all of you for allowing me to have the opportunity to work with one of the passions of my life.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Reverend Lawson. Struggle has only begun, as you said.
Peace.
You're listening to WLPN, 105.5 FM Chicago, and you're listening to Labor Express Radio, Chicago's only English-language labor news and current affairs radio program. News for working people by working people. I am your host, Jerry Mead Lacero. I'm going to start this program a bit differently than normal. Instead of giving you a preview up front of who and what we'll be talking about on tonight's program, let's play a little game of Name That Voice.
Today marks the beginning of the end of scapegoating educators for the social ills that all of our children, families, and schools struggle against every day. Today marks the beginning of a fight for true transparency in our educational policy. What drives school reform is a singular focus on profit. Profit, not teaching, not learning, profit. So in Chicago, we've seen CPS close 70 neighborhood schools, open up 70 charters that do no better. 6,000 Chicago teacher union members have lost their livelihoods, their jobs, their dignity in the process. Countless children have lost their friends and families, have lost schools that, for the most part, were a source of pride, tradition, and safety. Outside of the classroom, we need society to recommit to bettering all communities. We also need our parents to recommit to the education of their children with us. Mm-hmm. But inside the classroom, the only people who can improve our schools are professional educators. Corporate heads and politicians do not have a clue about teaching and learning. They have never sat 1 minute on this side of the teacher's desk. But they're the ones calling the shots, and we're supposed to accept it as reform. As a union of 30,000 United Educators, we have a lot of work to do. And we know we cannot do it alone. We need to work together and rethink what education means in Chicago.
That was obviously the great and unfortunately now late Karen Lewis. Karen, who first led CORE, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, and then was elected as president of the Chicago Teachers Union for two terms, passed away last Monday, February 8th. Karen had been battling cancer for years and had retired from active duty with the union in 2019. She remained an influence and inspiration to the union and held the title of President Emeriti until her passing last week. The speech you heard was, of course, from 2010 after her first election victory, in which Karen displaced the old guard leadership of the United Progressive Caucus, UPC, which had dominated the union for decades. Karen's victory and that of most of her slate empowered CORE and its energetic, fired-up membership ready to fight to challenge and transform the public education landscape in this city. And that they did. This is all the time we have for tonight's program. Labor Express is a nonprofit 501c3 member of IBEW Local 1220. The views expressed on Labor Express are those of its producers and not necessarily those of IBEW. Labor Express is a production of the Community for Labor Access in Chicago, the world capital of the labor movement. Labor Express is a proud member of the Labor Radio and Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. Find out more at laborradionetwork.org. The song is our theme is called Workers' Songs, written by Ed Pickford and recorded by the Dropkick Murphys. Tune in every Sunday at 8 p.m. or Monday at 11 a.m. on 105.5 FM or lumpenradio.com for more Labor Express.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day, with whistles blowing, the call to strike could be heard through the aisles of Woolworth in downtown Detroit. 108 saleswomen walked away from their workstations and cash registers. The 8-day sit-down had begun. The women saw from the experience in Flint that sit-down strikes were effective. They evicted management, barricaded the doors, and found 200 or so customers still inside the store wanting to join them. The strikers issued their demands: a 10-cent an hour raise, an 8-hour workday, union recognition and a union hiring hall, free uniforms and laundering, and more. Kresge department stores immediately gave their workers a raise in order to prevent similar stoppages. The striking women at Woolworth made themselves comfortable, and the sit-down soon spread to a second store. Leaders from Local 705 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union threatened a nationwide strike if demands were not met. Union cooks provided meals, and union musicians provided entertainment. Hotel workers from across the city picketed in front of the store in a show of solidarity. After 7 days, Woolworth's management caved and agreed to most of the strikers' demands. High turnover in the workforce would undo contract gains at area Woolworth stores soon after the sit-down. But the victory electrified retail workers across the country. The sit-down spread to retailers in St. Louis, New York, San Francisco, Minnesota, and Washington. In three strikes, miners, musicians, sales girls, and the fighting spirit of labor's last century, Dana Frank notes that, quote, over 60 years later, unions today in department stores all over the country owe their existence in part to the Woolworth strike. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. We'll be right back.
That's it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network's YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next time.